The 19th century psychologist William James once said, "All our life is but a mass of habits." It's certainly something ad men in the 20th century used to great advantage. As our colleague Renee Montaigne learned, getting people to buy a product over and over again means literally creating in them the habit of using that product.
In his new book, The Power of Habit, New York Times business reporter Charles Duhigg explores the science behind forming and changing habits and how that knowledge has been successfully employed in business, beginning with a rather basic set of behaviors, what he calls the habit loop.
There's a cue, which is kind of a trigger for an automatic behavior to start unfolding. And then there's a routine, which is the behavior itself, and this is usually what we think of when we think about habits. And then there's a reward, and the reward is what tells our brain whether we should store this habit for future use or not.
Let's begin, as you do in the book, with a particular habit that seems like it's been around from the beginning of time, but in fact is about 90 years old, the habit of brushing your teeth with a toothpaste. And in this case, we're talking about Pepsodent.
Exactly. About 100 years ago, no one in America brushed their teeth. No one was ever using toothpaste. So this one guy discovered a new toothpaste named Pepsodent, and he went to a friend of his, one of the nation's largest advertising executives, and said, "I've got this stuff, and I think we can make a killing." Now, the guy he went to, Claude C. Hopkins, had made his name creating habits around products and making them famous. He had these two simple rules. Make a product into a daily habit. Find some simple cue, something that's going to trigger the consumer. And second of all, you have to give them the reward, just like the habit loop that we just spoke about. He kind of intuited it years before laboratories had proven that it exists.
So his cue, which he figured out for Pepsodent toothpaste, was what?
The film you feel on your teeth. For years, people had felt a film on their teeth and had never worried about it. And you don't need toothpaste to get rid of it. But what he said was, "I can use this." And he created these posters that said, "Get rid of that film. Pepsodent gives you a beautiful smile." And what happened was, for the first time, people started buying toothpaste. Hopkins actually started the toothbrushing habit in America with Pepsodent.
Okay, but it wasn't just people worrying about the film on their teeth. That, as you write, would not have turned it into a daily routine that everyone did.
That's exactly right. What every consumer said was, "Well, after I brush my teeth, my mouth kind of tingles. And if I forget to brush my teeth, I miss that tingling. I crave that tingling." This gets to how habits work. The reason why these cues and rewards are so important is because over time, people begin craving the reward whenever they see the cue. And that craving makes a habit occur automatically.
You give an example of changing a habit that you call a keystone habit. And the example has to do with the company Alcoa.
That's right. For some reason, there are certain habits that seem to matter more than others. We call these keystone habits. And if you can change a keystone habit, you unlock all these other patterns in someone's life or in an organization. And the best example of this is Alcoa, the largest aluminum company on earth when Paul O'Neill took it over. And Paul O'Neill later became Treasury Secretary. When he first got hired, everyone expected him to come in and say, "I'm going to concentrate on profits and efficiency and making people work harder." But instead what he said was, "My number one priority is transforming worker safety habits within this company so that we have zero injuries," which is a big deal in a company where all of your employees handle molten metal.
How did the crescendo of other better habits fall out of changing one habit?
One of the characteristics of a keystone habit is that it creates a culture. That's why it seems to have such a profound influence on other patterns in our lives. For a long time, all the managers and the employees had kind of been at odds. In fact, there had been this huge strike of 15,000 workers at Alcoa. And then Paul O'Neill comes in and says, "Here's something that both of us can agree on. We need to change our habits around worker safety." And management and workers were able to sit down at the same table, and all of a sudden they realized to change those habits, to make safety automatic, you have to do certain things. Like, for instance, you have to look at your production line. when does the manufacturing process get out of whack? Because an out-of-whack manufacturing process is dangerous to employees. It also creates subpar aluminum. So if we make it safer for employees, if we bring everything in line, we actually make better aluminum also. By focusing on this one keystone habit, worker safety, Paul O'Neill set off a series of changes through the corporation that made it one of the most profitable companies on earth and one of the most efficient companies ever.
There's another example you use. It's for a particular product, Febreze, which is a pretty successful product now. But when it was introduced back in the 90s, it was a tough sell.
Febreze today is one of the most successful products on earth. It earns over $1 billion a year. But when it first was released, it was a complete flop because Febreze is this amazing spray that you can spray onto any fabric and it makes smells disappear. So if you have a dog on your couch and your couch smells terrible, if you spray Febreze on it, the smell just is eradicated. But the problem is that Procter & Gamble's marketers who were selling Febreze discovered people who have bad smells in their lives don't smell them after a little while. The cue for this habit completely disappears in people's lives. So what they did is they completely reformulated Febreze. It used to be something that was scentless. They invented a perfume that was strong enough to withstand the Febreze formula and poured it in so that Febreze had its own smell. And then instead of selling it to people who have bad smells in their lives, they decided to sell it to regular people who just clean their homes as the final step, the reward in a cleaning routine. They decided to piggyback on an existing habit.
The habit of cleaning and then the good feeling you have after you've put the final touches on some cleaning.
Exactly. It's that feeling at the end, oh, I just vacuumed the carpet. It looks so nice. And now I can give a little spray of Febreze, and all of a sudden things smell delightful. It's like a signal to myself that I've done a great job. All Procter & Gamble had to do was look for the cues and the rewards, and all of a sudden this product became a huge seller.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, absolutely.
Charles Duhigg is the author of The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business.
The Artist won 5 Oscars last night. That's the black and white silent movie set in the 1920s and 30s. The style of that movie tells you something about the style of last night's awards ceremony. NPR's Mandalit Del Barco was backstage.
This year's Oscars had a distinctly retro theme, most notably with The Artist. It tracks Hollywood's transition from the silent movies to the talkies, and it dominated the top awards for Best Picture of the Year, Best Director, Costume Design, Original Score, and leading actor Jean Dujardin. The French actor was anything but silent when he won for his portrayal of a silent picture star.
If George Valentine could speak, he'd say, wow, putain, génial, merci, formidable, merci beaucoup, I love you.
Dujardin also took the stage with the cast and co-star Jack Russell Terrier Uggie to accept the Best Picture Award. It was the first time a French actor and French filmmaker won the Oscars' Top Acting and Directing Awards, and The Artist was the first silent film to win Best Picture honors since the first Academy Awards in 1929. Dujardin noted how much times have changed.
It's funny because in 1929, it wasn't Billy Crystal, but Douglas Fairbanks who hosted the first Oscar ceremony. Tickets cost $5, and it lasted 15 minutes.
Backstage, producer Thomas Langman told reporters in this age of digital 3D blockbusters, it wasn't easy at first to convince studios to back The Artist.
No one wanted to help us making a silent black and white movie.
Another movie about the early days of cinema, Martin Scorsese's Hugo, also won 5 Oscars last night in the technical categories: visual effects, art direction, cinematography, and sound editing. Visual effects supervisor Rob Legato told reporters backstage that although Hugo was shot in 3D, the effects were not entirely computer generated.
Aside from paying homage to the subject of the movie, which was Georges Méliès and his techniques, there's still the better solution to get you something that looks real. And when you can do that, you should, and we did.
For the first time, an Iranian film, A Separation, won in the Best Foreign Language category. Here's director Asghar Farhadi backstage.
If people around the world try to find the image of one another through the prism of culture, I believe that image would be a more real and a more clear image.
This year, the Oscars were held in what was until very recently known as the Kodak Theater, until the Kodak company took away its sponsorship as part of its bankruptcy. Host Billy Crystal had a new name for it.
We're here at the beautiful Chapter 11 Theater.
It was decked out as an old-time movie palace, and during one intermission, attendants walked through the aisles giving out treats. The show itself seemed bent on the idea of selling movie magic on the big screen to an audience used to downloading movies on handheld devices. Throughout the telecast, big movie names like Julia Roberts and Tom Cruise joined Werner Herzog and Robert Downey Jr. in giving testimonials to the silver screen.
It sticks to you forever. It never leaves you. It becomes part of your existence.
The Outlaw Josie Wales.
A Place in the Sun.
Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot.
It just gets into my soul. It just makes me happy.
So I guess in that way, it's not just thrill me and entertainment. It's I want to be transported. Not that where I am is intolerable, though it might be.
Billy Crystal was on stage for the 9th time as host, and he joked about the aging demographics of the Hollywood nominees.
Happy birthday, Oscar. He's 84, you know. What does age matter, especially in this town? You know, look at some of our nominees tonight. Christopher Plummer is 82, maybe walking up on stage tonight. He may be walking up on stage tonight because apparently he wanders off.
Christopher Plummer, in fact, did win for Best Supporting Actor in the film Beginners. In triumph, he talked directly to his golden Oscar.
You're only 2 years older than me, darling. Where have you been all my life?
Meryl Streep, who had been nominated for awards 17 times, won her 3rd Oscar, this time as leading actress for her portrayal of British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher.
When they called my name, I had this feeling I could hear half of America going, oh, no. Oh, come on, why? Her. Again, you know? But whatever.
Backstage, Meryl Streep said after all these years, it actually was still a thrill to hear her name being called as winner. It was Octavia Spencer's first nomination, and she came away with the Best Supporting Actress Award for her role as an outspoken maid in 1960s Mississippi.
Oh, thank you.
Spencer was so emotional, she cried throughout her speech. Backstage, she paid tribute to those who made their voices heard during the civil rights era, like the characters portrayed in The Help.
I'm a benefactor of all of the riches that the real life Minnie, Abilene's, Constantine, Skeeter's, Celia's, that they basically reaped. And so I'm very humbled because I get to stand here and accept this award.
Among those cheering her on was a group of real-life domestic workers who gathered to watch the Oscars in Los Angeles. But with a lackluster telecast, there was perhaps more drama outside the theater on the red carpet. Comic actor Sacha Baron Cohen showed up decked out as a bearded dictator to promote his new movie. His character had threatened unimaginable consequences if he wasn't allowed to attend the ceremony. He ended up throwing ashes on red carpet host Ryan Seacrest. Best Actor nominees George Clooney and Brad Pitt hammed it up for the screaming fans in the bleachers. And the composer of this year's Best Original Song, Brett McKenzie, serenaded NPR with his winning tune.
Oh, I'll sing you the chorus. That's the better.
Am I a man or am I a Muppet?
Am I a Muppet?
If I'm a Muppet, well, I'm a very manly Muppet.
Only time will tell if Man or Muppet becomes a classic. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Hollywood.
You hear her on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
yesterday afternoon, the University of Kansas men's basketball team staged a dramatic comeback to defeat the Missouri Tigers 87-86.
The Jayhawks came from 19 down. Kansas wins it in overtime.
Never mind the exciting finish. This may be the last time these two longtime rivals will ever meet. And it's not the only feud ending this season. College sports has now bid farewell to three of its very oldest rivalries. NPR's Becky Sullivan has a story.
The pairs West Virginia and Pittsburgh, Texas and Texas A&M, and Kansas and Missouri have all played each other over 100 times in football, and way more than that in men's basketball. The intensity that comes with that kind of history cannot be understated. These three rivalries are so passionate that 5 years ago, it was impossible to see their breakups coming. The border war between Kansas and Missouri has its roots in what was quite literally a border war over slavery in the 1850s, and the two schools started battling in sports back in 1891. Texas and Texas A&M have faced off 118 times in football, over half of them the iconic Thanksgiving Day showdown. And take the feud between the universities of West Virginia and Pittsburgh, the backyard brawl. The two teams, who both wear shades of blue and gold, have played each other since 1895, and West Virginia alum Jason Keel isn't happy it's ending.
I dread the day when we aren't looking across the way and seeing those players and fans dressed in the other gold and blue. I dread that day.
He and dozens of other West Virginia fans were watching the 184th edition of the Backyard Brawl at Ragtime, a sports bar in Arlington, Virginia. So why are all these rivalries ending?
We're at a crossroads in college athletics where the almighty dollar rules the day.
That's Fran Fischilla, a college basketball analyst for ESPN. He says that TV networks like ESPN and CBS are one of the biggest factors behind conference realignment. Here's how it works. Some conferences, like the Southeastern Conference, are really good at football, so they command more lucrative TV contracts, which in turn means more money for its members. Again, Fran Fischilla.
You want to be able to have a good seat in a good conference. And because some conferences generate so much revenue, schools are making decisions primarily based on financial implications.
In the case of these three rivalries, the schools moving away are Texas A&M, Missouri, and both West Virginia and Pittsburgh. And though that may mean a few million more bucks for those athletic departments, Fischilla says it's done permanent damage to the culture of college sports.
There's going to be a certain flavor missing because we're not going to see some of these storied rivalries anymore.
Look at it this way. Next season, instead of the traditional Turkey Day football game between Texas and Texas A&M, the Longhorns settled for the Horned Frogs of TCU. Safe to say that matchup won't have the same luster. And it's tough to say who will become Missouri's SEC rival. Back at Ragtime, I asked Jason Keel if West Virginia might find a new rival, but his answer was firm.
No. There's only one Pitt.
It's easy to understand why the universities are leaving each other, he says, but it's still very disappointing to see the rivalries let go.
We deserve to say, who's better than you? I want the bragging rights. You want the bragging rights. Let's play the game.
For the backyard brawl, at least, it's very likely. But for Kansas and Missouri, well, let's just say the bad blood runs a little too deep. Kansas coach Bill Self didn't mince words after the team's first matchup this season.
I don't feel bad. Missouri wanted this, so why should I feel bad? And I don't feel bad for anybody.
And yesterday afternoon, the final buzzer sounded on the border war. And with the conference title on the line, they saved the best for last.
It's Cressy, guarded by Johnson. Takes it all the way. Block! Tip! Overtime!
There's a chance the two will face each other in postseason tournaments to come, but never again as conference rivals, never again on their home courts, never again like this.
How fitting in the 267th game.
For NPR News, I'm Becky Sullivan.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. It's Oscar night in Hollywood, and that means glamorous parties all over the city. But this year, a particular group of women will be hosting parties to cheer on two nominees, actors Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, who portrayed maids in the film The Help. As NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports now, those parties will try to raise awareness for the rights of domestic workers.
The Help is a movie about black maids in segregated Mississippi who make the lives of their white employers easier by doing their household work. Here's Viola Davis's character, Abilene, describing her job.
I work for the Lee Faults from 8 to 4, 6 days a week. I make 95 cents an hour. That comes to $182 every month.
For that, she does everything, cooking, cleaning, and raising the Lee Fault toddler, Mae Mobley. Abilene and her fellow housekeeper, Minnie, are fictional, but...
There are Abilenes and Minnies in every town and every city, and that each one of us has a role to play in really bringing respect and dignity to their work.
That's Ai-Jin Poo, director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance, a network devoted to securing rights for the nation's estimated 2 million housekeepers, nannies, and home caregivers. After a 6-year grassroots campaign, Poo successfully got a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights passed in the New York State Legislature. The bill was the first of its kind in the country. It regulated working hours and work conditions and mandated that employers pay the legal minimum wage. Now, Poo has her sights on California.
We call it the Wild West because it's so unpredictable, and oftentimes what you're looking at is a situation where workers are highly vulnerable to abuse.
A California bill similar to the one in New York was passed in the state assembly and will soon go to the Senate for a floor vote. But as with New York, there has been resistance. Opposing lawmakers say regulating hours, overtime, and other workplace conventions for domestic workers means many working families will not be able to afford the nannies and housekeepers they rely on. Anticipating that, the National Domestic Workers Alliance has created a campaign called Be the Help to raise public awareness of the value of domestic work. They're keying off the current craze for the movie to remind employers that they are able to do their jobs because of the help they have at home. Jennifer Bernard has been a New York nanny for 20 years and wants the Help's fans to keep this in mind.
I want them to really remember that the domestic worker is an important person in their home, that we take care of their most prized possession every day. And if they go out to seek a job, they want to be treated in a special way, and we want to be treated the same.
Bernard will be at one of the scores of viewing parties being held on Oscars night to emphasize the importance of domestic work. She hopes if Octavia Spencer wins an Oscar, she'll repeat her moving speech from the Golden Globes.
You know, with regard to domestics in this country now and then, I think Dr. King said it best. All labor that uplifts humanity has dignity and importance, and I thank you for recognizing that with our film.
Anne Bernard hopes the movie will continue to raise awareness so that California and other states will pass laws aimed at giving domestic workers many of the same protections that govern others in the workplace. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Tomorrow, the Republican presidential candidates are facing two important primaries. Polls and contests in Arizona and Michigan initially showed the once-designated frontrunner, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, falling behind former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum.
But the latest figures now have Romney tied or slightly ahead. Wins for Romney in those two states would still, though, not provide him with any knockout blows.
And let's talk about this with Cokie Roberts, who's a regular contributor to Morning Edition. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, David.
Well, even as Mitt Romney has managed to erase his deficit in the polls in the states that we're talking about for tomorrow, he's still having trouble sealing the deal in Michigan, and that's notable. I mean, that's his home state, right, where his father was governor, his mother is a respected civic leader. I mean, tell us what's going on. Is this Romney failing to do something, or is this a matter of what the party is looking for right now?
Well, it's both. Romney keeps managing to say just the wrong thing all of the time. So he stepped on his own economic message on Friday when he talked about the American cars his family drives and said, my wife drives a couple of Cadillacs, one at one house and one at another. It's not exactly your average family situation. And when he was asked about it over the weekend, he said, well, he's not perfect, but that if Americans don't want a successful person, they shouldn't vote for him. And that's going to be his mantra. But then last night, when he went to the not run Daytona 500 and asked whether he follows NASCAR, he said, no, but I've got a couple of friends who are NASCAR owners. Again, it's the kind of 10-year that makes his advisors and key supporters tear their hair out.
Not everyone can have friends who are owners of NASCAR.
No. And some of those supporters are the governors of both Michigan and Arizona who've endorsed Romney and have something to lose if he loses. But their endorsements also could be a problem for him because it's a year when voters don't want to take what they see as advice or orders from anybody. And that's where the difference in the Republican Party shows up. It is a different party than he ran in 4 years ago. And we're seeing it in state after state. Indiana Senator Richard Lugar's in trouble. Orrin Hatch is in trouble. In Utah, Tommy Thompson, who was governor's highly successful governor of Wisconsin, is in an uphill fight to come into the Senate. So a guy like Santorum, who lost his Senate reelection in Pennsylvania by a huge landslide in 2006, is now popular because the party has moved so far to the right.
Well, let's talk about Rick Santorum and his effort to connect with the party. I mean, he's having some of his own problems as voters are getting to know him a bit better.
And today he has an op-ed on economics in the Wall Street Journal, but he spent the weekend saying things that do seem out of the mainstream. He said President Kennedy, then candidate Kennedy's separation of church and state speech, quote, made me want to throw up. And he said President Obama's drive for every American kid to have the opportunity to go to college was a bad idea.
President Obama once said he wants everybody in America to go to college. What a snob. They're good, decent men and women who go out and work hard every day and put their skills to test that aren't taught by some liberal college professor.
Now, I don't think most Americans think that their kids shouldn't go to college for ideological reasons. The effect of all of this, David, is that people in the party, the governors were here in Washington this weekend, are beginning to say maybe we need another candidate. Maybe we need a brokered convention, a wide-open convention. Now, those things tend not to happen. But there's a tremendous amount of nervousness, particularly with a new poll out today showing President Obama beating any Republican handily and doing very well with independents.
So still a chance for a fresh face in the time that we have left. As political commentator, Cokie Roberts.